You're listening to The Cowboy Pages. Come with me, Christy Crowley, as I travel America in search of cowboy poets and their wisdom. Today's book, Northern Arizona. Chapter 2, If It's Your Best, a chat with cowboy and reciter, Jerry Brooks. Jerry Brooks, or Brooksy, as she's known to her friends, is one of the most respected reciters of cowboy poetry around. Her distinctive voice and personal charisma blend to make a mark on each poem she performs. Brooksy spends her days now tending to over 40 acres of land near Clear Creek, Utah. But previously, she worked as a coal miner in the western United States. The U.S. Department of Labor lists coal mining as one of the most dangerous occupations in our nation. The fact that anyone could endure this work I find amazing, but the fact that it's an industry so heavily dominated by men led me to believe Brooksy might have some very interesting insights into what it means to be a woman in a man's world. I was able to meet with Brooksy while she was staying at the Spider Ranch, the home of fellow cowboy poets Amy Hale Locker and Gail Steiger. There's something about the air in Arizona that always feels so different to me. As I got up that morning and left the cozy, warm, well-appointed guest house in which I'd been installed, the crisp, early spring air bit my nose and woke me right up. I took a stroll around the headquarters of Spider Ranch, walking around the main house and the stables. I mostly noticed the calm. It's by no means quiet. The birds were chirping and flying at breakneck speeds, the horses were having their breakfasts, and unidentified little critters seemed to scamper everywhere I went. But there was still a calm, a sense of everything in its place, a sense of everyone attending to the task at hand. I felt instantly more grounded. I knew I'd need my feet underneath me to meet with Brooksy, and I think the walk was a very good idea. Jerry Brooks.
The Vacant Chair by Henry S. Washburn. We shall meet, but we shall miss him. There will be one vacant chair. We shall linger to caress him while we breathe our evening prayer. When a year ago we gathered, joy was in his mild blue eye. Now a golden cord is severed and our hopes in ruins lie. At the fireside, sad and lonely, oft-times will a bosom swell at remembrance of the story, how our noble Willie fell. How he strove to bear our banner through the thickest of the fight and uphold his country's honor in the strength of manhood's might. True, they tell us wreaths of glory evermore shall deck his brow, but that soothes the anguish only sweeping o'er our heartstrings now. Sleep today, O early fallen, in your green and narrow bed. Dirges from the pines and cypress mingle with the tears we've shed. We shall meet, but we shall miss him. There will be one vacant chair. We shall linger to caress him while we breathe our evening prayer.
I met you a few years ago while we were working in San Francisco. How did it feel to you being in that city? What was your sense of that?
Well, first off, I'll say Frisco ain't bad for a city as far as cities go, but I have a big problem making myself not bear witness and not feeling, not being horrified, not being so just overwhelmed with the horrible things I see in cities that it was a very unpleasant trip for me in a lot of ways. Yeah. Just because of that. I do not spend time in urban surroundings anymore, since simply because it just inundates me and overwhelms me with the horror.
Yeah.
I watch people walk in their little personal tunnels down those sidewalks without even having the grace to acknowledge what is so obvious right there alongside them. Yeah. People starving in the streets. People dying in the streets, living in the streets, filth, trash, just the absence of what is best in this world. I see no beauty in cities. My brother is he's an urban rat. He's a city rat. You know, he loves it because it's so involved, because he can see beauty in an urban skyline. I'm not capable of that. I hear people describe, photographs, huge aerial views of New York and Chicago, and just think that they're marvelous. It's a wonderful thing, and I feel nothing but utter disgust. I see no beauty at all in it. And I wonder, how do these people that, for whatever reason, make themselves remain in those urban centers? We're becoming two entirely different species of human beings. I honestly believe that. And I don't know what to do about it or whether we're supposed to do anything about it, but it scares me.
Thank you for that. Where do you see beauty? Where does beauty live in your life?
There's sky, there's earth, there's water, there's air. The world is beautiful just as it is, just as it was created. I'm happy with a stick and a rock. I find beauty in stones. I find beauty in a piece of wood. I see men that are wonderful sculptors and will take a beautiful piece of wood, and yes, they carve from that wood something of beauty, and yet wasn't the beauty already innate to the wood? And when I'll work with a piece of wood or one of my little sculptures or something, it's fine the way it is, but let's enhance it a little more. Let's bring out make it its own beauty plus.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just enough for me.
So then let me ask you about, you create walking sticks. Is that a fair?
Walking sticks, wood sculptures.
And how do you come to decide what piece of wood you're going to use? How do you...
Well, for a walking stick, it gets a little more picky because you need to get the pieces that won't split, that aren't good. They have to be strong. There's some sticks that are just, strolling accessories more than they are walking sticks. You wouldn't want to bank your broken leg on one,
Yes. Yes. Are these available to people if someone wanted to see these or buy these, or where would they go? How would they access them? They're beautiful.
Come see me.
Okay. Very good.
That's the easiest way to get anything out of me is just come see me.
I had no idea that you even did them until I saw them, I think maybe a couple of years ago. I was absolutely blown away. They're really beautiful.
Well, I first started making the sticks because I needed them. With my hips and the hip, and after I got my hip replacement, got my new hip, and it felt so good, and I said, I don't need these anymore. Here. Anyone want to buy a stick?
That's great. So tell me about the place that you live in Utah, yes?
Yes, yes.
And is this a ranch? Is it?
No, it's a small property, 80 acres.
Small. Just 80 acres.
Yeah, but it's long and narrow in the bottom of the canyon, goes right up for a half mile along the creek. The owners that happened now. Alan wanted to get it back into his family. It had been his grandmother's, on his mother's side, homestead. She had married into the Alcott family. It was the Alcott family homestead. And when Alan got ready to retire, he wanted to get that property back. But they just need a presence there. They need someone there just to keep vandals out and just look after things and just be a presence. I fell into the deal, and it's been wonderful. Yeah.
And where in Utah is it?
It's Clear Creek Canyon. It's on the north slope of the Tusher Mountains. It's one of the mountain passes in southern Utah through that bony ridge that goes down the middle of the state.
So, Brixie, I want to talk to you a little bit about your life as a poet or reciter of poetry. How did that come to be? Was poetry always in your life?
Yes.
Even as a child?
Yes. Very much. Very much. I'm lucky to have had the resources that I did in the home, plus, very convenient libraries of other sorts, whether public or private. I recited when I was very young. I liked poetry, and I would read a lot. And I actually was reciting poetry when I was about 7. I'm sure it was just absolutely delightful. Yeah. To listen to a 7-year-old brat trying to recite The Highwaymen. I get poor audiences. But then, of course, as you're growing up and going through school, you drop those interests and move on to other things. But I always read poetry. And I always had, there was poetry that I dearly loved all through high school. But coming back to it through the so-called cowboy poetry genre, it was wonderful because so many of our stories have such commonality and can run in the parallel tracks to a lot of the cowboy poetry stories. It's all poetry. It blends very well.
How do you come to a piece? How do you decide it's a piece you're going to perform?
Sometimes I don't get to make that choice. I have had poems that come to me, and they're usually the best ones. I'll have another poem in mind, and honest to gosh, I wanted to commit Where the Ponies Come to Drink to memory, Henry Herbert Nibbs. And I finally got a volume of Henry Herbert Nibbs' poetry, and every time I would open it to Where the Ponies Come to Drink, the pages would fall back open to the walking man. And I said, no, not you yet. You someday. But I want... And the book is like, no. You want to learn the walking man. Yeah, and then there's other poems that I've heard them so many times, and I'd be thinking to myself, gosh, I wish I knew that poem. And then I said, well, let's see. How does it start? And I'd sit down and start, and by golly, I did know it. I had no idea I knew it, but I knew it. Or well enough for a good foundation to, get it right, which takes a long time someday. Some poems, some days.
I want to ask you actually about a specific piece that I absolutely love. I think it might be the first piece I ever heard you do, if memory serves. Morning on the Desert.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Would you tell a little bit about the story of how you came to that piece?
I heard a man perform it in Spanish Fork, Utah. I have no idea how many years ago. And he was unable to tell me the author's name. But he thought it had been from some family member. Stories abound about the origin of the poem. A lot of times you'll see it with an epigraph that says, found on the inside of a cabin door on the Arizona or the Nevada or the Utah or the California desert. I've heard at least 3 different people claim that it was written by a family member. But through the efforts of Margot Medegrano at cowboypoetry.com, yay, Margot, she found the author's name. It was published on postcards back in the 20s and 30s and hand-tinted. Her name was never on there. But Margot had started researching this female Western woman writing poetry, and just got a cover of one of her copy of one of her books, "Songs from the Sagebrush," and the poem was in there. It was written by Catherine Fall Petty.
Wow!
So it was quite a revelation. I've had other poems that were mystery poems as far as finding out who wrote them, but you know, it took me 7 years to find out who wrote Morning on the Desert.
Wow. What is your relationship to the poets whose work you perform?
I am a reciter. I do not call myself a poet, because, quite frankly, my poetry's not that good. I'd rather steal good stuff. But if you are going to make that obligation to perform other people's stories, you have responsibilities to those stories and to those authors. I hope that I will always be capable of presenting a story in the way that the author intended it. And I strive for that. You can read stories, you can read lines, you can read poems a lot of different ways. And that's the wonderful thing about listening to your friends and the way they go at a poem, is to see that variance and say, oh gosh, I never thought of it that way. Maybe that is what he meant. That emphasis on the word, or that kind of, just the way you will say a line, deliver a line, can change the meaning for a whole portion of a poem, if not the whole poem, I suppose. Yeah, you'll hear that with singers. You listen to the same song done by different singers, and you get a completely different flavor. It's as if there's a completely different intent to the telling of the story.
Yeah. That's very, very true. I want to shift gears just a little bit, because I in some ways feel I would be remiss not to ask you this. I work in San Francisco in a fairly male-dominated world, and I know that you worked in a coal mine.
Yeah.
And I wonder about that, and I wonder about your experience working in another very male-dominated world. Was gender even an issue?
When people get into the gender discussion, it rather blindsides me. I suppose I'm so self-contained and self-centered that it was never an issue for me, because I know I can do this job. And if I am willing to tell a person, yes, I will do this for in exchange for the paycheck that you will give me, then I'm going to do that job. I wouldn't be there. I wouldn't take it on otherwise if I didn't believe myself fully capable of doing the whole job. And this is where I fall down with a lot of women's rightists and some feminists. I mean, really irritate the hell out of me. If you want equality in thought, in pay, in regard, in respect, then do the whole job. Okay, some fellows are very reactionary, especially there in Utah. There are men of a mindset that women have no business doing this, this, or this. You know, women are supposed to do this and that. But the best way to deal with it is to simply do all that is expected and more. do whatever you can, and you do a job to the best of your abilities. And if it's your best, it'll be good enough. Yeah.
That's great. Thank you for sharing that. I've maybe strong-armed you or roped you into perhaps doing a little piece for us.
Okay. Well, yeah, you did give me a little heads up and a little warning, but my powers of concentration have not been great lately. But the one that came to mind was just an excerpt out of Buck Ramsey's work, Grass. I suppose, you know, we could have segued in just from that conversation of a woman taking on a position a man would usually occupy. Young men go through the exact experiences that I would have gone through when I first entered, you know, that working field or the other working fields where I've always worked in close conjunction with men. But a young man going forward into what he believes he wants his life to be, he's going through the exact same battles. He has to make the exact same points. He has to prove, whether to himself or somebody else, that he is capable. And I identify and I work with young men very well. So I guess that's why Grass came to mind. Mm-hmm. And this was the part that was rattling through my brain last night. Young Billy Deaver is at the cow camp now. He's made the effort to go out and get there, and the cowboys have taken him under their wings and have gotten him outfitted. When Buck did this whole story as an excerpt, he called it "The Kid Is Outfitted," and yet I'm cutting it down even more. They've given the kid his chaps. They've given him a good hat. They've given him a rope to use, a riata to use, and are letting him learn. Great. At his own pace. They handed him a string of horses with all the hues of Joseph's coat, and tracing from the blooded source of old Pegasus' faunch and gloat, and our Bellerophontes mounted his winged steed and proudly counted the labors that before him lay, and measured works to fit each day. And such were his days in the saddle, the prairie goddess smiled on him, till sometime it seemed seraphim were riding with him, herding cattle. In fact, such were his grace and skill, some jealous god might wish him ill. Young Billy, mounting in the morning, hairpinned his horse in one smooth stride. Then, horse away and boy adorning, became a centaur, all in stride. He stayed the sunfish and fence rowing, stayed all the bronco tricks for throwing the peelers who'd climbed on their backs. They quickly came to him, those knacks some rode for years without possessing. Uncanny aimers seemed to guide his looped riata of rawhide. And this, he had his partner's blessing. Young Billy always seemed to find the right place, horseback, the right time. I've seen him 10 long years a horseback, punching cattle for short pay. Not match that boy aboard a good horse, the rancher told his wife one day. That youngster studies what's around him. Why, I swear one day out there I found him intent upon a cow and calf. And when I asked, I had to laugh when he said he was busy learning what mama cows say to their kin. He hears the message on the wind, feels the axis at its turning. There are those to the leather born whose hearts beat to hoof and horn. Buck Ramsey.
Brooksy, that's beautiful. You have a very special relationship with Buck Ramsey's material.
And I honestly wouldn't be able to tell you why. I don't know what I ever did to deserve it, but it was, his works are some of those that came to me. I was gifted them. I was blessed with them. Buck had a very strong sense of the camaraderie, the commonalities, and the inclusiveness of some poetic schools of thought that may to most people not seem cowboy. And it's through his efforts and his effect on the genre that I've been granted the inclusiveness that I've felt within the community, within the tribe.
Well, I thank you for sharing his work with me. I don't know that I would have had access to it had it not been for you. And so you are truly a steward of his work and lifted off the page.
I hope I always will be. Yeah.
I hope so too.
I truly do. I want to do more and more of Buck's material. But so many poems, so little time.
Brooksy, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Christy.
There it is. Certainty. That assuredness in one's own abilities and one's own place in the world. Having left the quiet serenity of the desert and a conversation with a woman I deeply admire, I found myself feeling assaulted by the sheer volume of the airport in which I waited for my flight. All of these people and all of us was somewhere else to be? As I waited at the luggage counter to check my bag, I was struck almost dumb by the image of two women in full burqas, only a sliver of their eyes visible. And just behind them stood a young woman with bleach blonde hair, a short, tight skirt, 5-inch heels, and a hot pink tank top with the words, "Spiritual Gangster," splashed across its front. I couldn't help but question which amongst these women was actually a spiritual gangster. But maybe that's just it. Maybe all women are in some way the keeper of a spiritual light that only they can know and honor. I'm grateful to Brooksy for reminding me that certainty comes through experience and that strength comes in knowing you can do the job and then doing it. And I'm grateful to you too for listening. Next time, I'll be traveling through South Dakota to meet and chat with the great poets of the plains. Join me, won't you? You can learn more about our show, Cowboy Poets, and see pictures of my travels at thecowboypages.com.